and smestions.
George Lang. Hello, by the way, and welcome. This is another take.
Caught me by surprise.
George Lang, in hot and humid Bahrain, how pulse deficient do you have to be to not be an executive producer? The Jack Ryan series, currently on Prime Video, has Tom Clancy as an executive producer, and he died in 2013. For the record, I very much enjoy the TV series, as do I. John Krasinski, also as executive producer, and Wendell Pierce are superb in their roles. And back in the day, I enjoyed the books whilst commuting to and from Glasgow from Darkest Ayrshire. Tom already has the based on characters by credit, and I'm sure his estate don't need the additional fee. Also, what do the other executive producers with a pulse who have actually made a contribution think of having the same title as a corpse? There must be a Weekend at Bernie's joke, but I can't quite get there. However, maybe Tom's contribution needs to be a more honest and relevant title, such as Clear and Not Present Producer or Sum of All Fees Producer. George Lang, Executive Producer Extraordinaire. So it's a very kind of strange title. It kind of means everything and nothing, doesn't it?
It is a really weird thing, executive production, because it can mean a number of different things. Quite often people just get executive producer credits because they ask for them, or it's just a way of it's a way of getting points. Some executive, like, for example, if your executive producer is Steven Spielberg, he probably has at some point had some kind of hands-on involvement. If it's a name, sometimes actors, for example, will ask for an executive producer credit because it gives them some kind of, it's a credit, that's all it does. But it is one of those incredibly woolly terms. I didn't know that about the post-life executive production credit. I can, however, tell you my best production story, which is if you watch The French Connection, The French Connection has as one of its producer credits, and it might be an executive producer credit, David G. Shine. And I said to Friedkin, who is David G. Shine? And he went, oh, well, when The French Connection was made, at some point, the property of the French, because The French Connection is based on a real story, somebody else had optioned the book at some point. And then nothing had happened with it. And then they had ended up making The French Connection. And because of the way that production credits work, the original production credit had to stand. So I said, did you ever meet David Shine? And he went, yes, I met him on stage at the Oscars when we received the Oscar for Best Picture.
Wow.
So that was literally the first time he'd ever met the guy. Because he had nothing to do with the film except that he had a version of it at some point.
But he got an Oscar.
Yeah.
Or shared it.
That's how it works.
An email from
G. David Shine. That's his name. Executive producer. There he was.
Correspondence at CurbanAmail.com. Now, an email from Theo Dombrowski. It could be Dombrowski because it's got a W.
Okay. Dombrowski.
Dombrowski. Theo Dombrowski.
Yeah, I would say.
I go with that. Whilst paddling my kayak off Vancouver Island this morning and catching up on my favourite podcast, as one does, I just about fell out of my tippy vessel when Simon mentioned his good friend, former Labour MP Douglas Alexander. This is when we were talking about the story about passing the duchy on the left-hand side.
That's very good, which is a very, very good gag.
Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. To be filed in the folder of It's a Small World is the fact that Douglas, you see, was for 2 years in the English class that I taught at an international college on Vancouver Island. Like the rest of the 200 students from something like 70 different countries, Douglas had got himself there on a full scholarship, in his case, to represent Scotland. Whilst Wikipedia records this part of his career, I just checked, it does not record one of the many ridiculously memorable things about a 17-ish year old Douglas, namely the fact that with a devilish sparkle in his eyes and voice, he would allow few class discussions to go by without his finding a way, by hook or by crook, of using his favourite delicious phrase. Who could have thought that this phrase, which I would say is searing indictment, given heft with a proper Scottish rolled R, could be brandished in so many contexts. Given his subsequent career, it seems likely that this phrase stood him in soberingly regular good stead. Douglas was also under my purported care as one of 40 students in the residence of which I and my wife were so-called house fellows. That's another story. So here's my schmestion to you.
Okay.
Do Simon and Mark, both now famous in their fine quiver full of favourite phrases and expressions, recall latching onto and deploying with gusto in their youthful years a similar phrase, too delicious not to overuse? It's a very specific question. Was there a phrase that you used a lot back in the day?
You know, I struggle to think of, there are phrases that I use, like a bunch of stuff is something that I said, but
that is true, you still use that.
So I still use a bunch of stuff. I think partly that came from, remember being told a story about Terry Gilliam looking out of a window of a plane and looking at the sea and going, look, it's a bunch of water, because it was just a phrase that he used. But does it need to be in relation to anything particular?
No, I think something you just enjoyed saying. I can't think of anything really.
Yeah, a bunch of stuff. I say it's spinach and to hell with it, but I know where that came from. I say that a lot. But that comes from...
spinach and to hell with it.
I say it's spinach and to hell with it. And somebody once said to me, why do you say that? And I said, it's because it's a line from the Ninth Configuration. There's a lot of lines from the Ninth Configuration that I find really funny. But that's the one that makes that amusing me.
You might
most.
Often be in a room with people and you're the only one.
Yes, but it's like if somebody's saying something about this and this and this and this and this, and you go, well, I say it's spinach and to hell with it.
And everyone goes, what?
Pardon?
So anyway, I sent all that to from Theo to the aforementioned Douglas Alexander, who said he was a brilliant English literature teacher, genuinely the best teacher I ever had. So his email confirms that you have the very highest caliber of Canadian listener. He would litter, he would litter my essays with brutal, if insightful, feedback, including regularly pointing out the use of the vague this phrase. So if you said, this highlights the brilliance of the Kermode and Mayo Take podcast, you would get your essay back with a carefully written... vague this next to the sentence. So I think I might use that. I think
vague
vague this. Anyway, correspondence.
I know what phrase I still use.
Yeah, but you've been banned from using that at home, so I don't see why you should
use it here.
Using it here. Lisa in Toronto, what fictional restaurant do you wish was real?
Oh, you mean any? Can I have any? Well, restaurant. Yes. The restaurant at the end of the universe.
The first one that I wrote.
Is it?
Yes, restaurant at the end of the universe. Okay.
The Douglas Adams. I would love the diner in Diner to be real, though I know it's based on, you know, the other thing is, if we count Mel's Drive-In from American Graffiti, because of course Mel's Drive-In had basically stopped being a big successful chain, and then American Graffiti happened, and then Mel's Drive-In became a successful chain off the back of American Graffiti, which is why if you now go down Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset, whichever one it is, there's a huge Mel's Drive-In with all the pictures of American Graffiti around on it. But restaurant at the end of the universe, I would love to be
real. Okay, I'll put in the... Is it Gusto's, which is the restaurant in Ratatouille?
Oh, okay, yeah, that's a good one.
That would be fun. Also, the Three Broomsticks.
Is that Harry Potter?
In Harry Potter. When we did the live show at Union Chapel, the first one, you talked about Bob's Burgers.
Bob's Burgers, yeah.
That sounds like a decent place
to go. It's a decent place, yeah. It's funny that we both went for restaurant at the end of the universe.
Yeah, it was the first one that occurred to me.
Because there's the thing about the whole point is it's teetering on the, you know, it's there, it's on the thing, and then this MC does, you know, and then the broiling blah, 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 and afterwards, nothingness, except our dessert trolley.
Excellent. Matthew says, medium-term listener, first-time emailer, inhabitant of the blind pews, which is where I imagine fellow sight-impaired members of the church abide. Following recent musing on music and film, I had an evening of film soundtrack fun that raised... You're obviously the person to be talking about this. That raised the thought, are there many films where the theme or soundtrack go beyond enhancing the film watching to becoming the defining memory? This came from a listen to Isaac Hayes' theme from Shaft, where I would submit that there are few films that could live up to the promise delivered by the opening 30 seconds of that song. I played the full album version last weekend.
It is belting, isn't it? It is absolutely belting.
Following recent reflections on the Indiana Jones franchise, I think a serious argument could be made that the John Williams theme stands up better than the films. I have no doubt there are others.
That's interesting.
But I'd be interested in the Good Doctor's views on soundtracks that leave the project they were originally linked to in the cold.
We did a thing on Scala Radio called Great Soundtrack, Shame About the Film. And the one that really came out on top was Ed Harcourt's music for S. Darko, which was the awful sequel to Donnie Darko. But the music is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's a really fantastic soundtrack to a terrible film. I would also include Ennio Morricone's music for Exorcist II, The Heretic, because obviously The Heretic is the worst film ever made, but that soundtrack is kind of bonkers. What was it?
Hands off the mic.
Could you hear it?
Yes, you were rattling the cable against the microphone.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Ennio Morricone's music for Exorcist II, The Heretic is definitely one of those kind of standout things when the film is all over the place, but it's great. I'd also say that the soundtrack album for Barry Lyndon, I mean, I love Barry Lyndon, the film, but I could play the soundtrack album to Barry Lyndon over and over again without it being connected to the film.
Question here from Alex in Austria.
Okay.
I think this is mainly aimed at me. The good lady UN lawyer her indoors will be reassigned to a new station in Copenhagen as of next year.
This is for you, yeah.
Unfortunately, okay. When she thinks about Copenhagen, the main things that come to her mind are rain, overpriced food, a lack of mountains, and quite reserved people. Your help in altering, or to be fair, extending her image of Copenhagen would be much appreciated. Could you list a few of your personal favourite things about Copenhagen that you look forward to when visiting the city, apart from family, of course? I already tried the argument, but Simon Mayo's son lives there. It can't be that bad. Didn't have any effect. I can't imagine why. Thanks for everything, and down with the Dansk Folkeparti and the Freiheitliche Partei Österreich, which might not be Nazis but promote quite questionable worldviews, so you can kind of guess what kind of...
Okay.
So Alex from Austria and the good lady UN lawyer, her indoors. So I consulted widely on this on the family WhatsApp.
You said, tell me good things about Copenhagen.
Well, yeah, well, obviously family is the main reason that we go. That is the reason.
How do
that
they pronounce it in Copenhagen?
Copenhagen.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not Copenhagen, it's Copenhagen, and it's got a K.
At the beginning?
Yes, it's Copenhagen. Anyway, so there you go.
My mind is blown.
Bakeries. So these are the things that I got back.
Okay, fine.
The metro is a fantastic. It's a small city. It's definitely flat. Can't hide the lack of mountains. The metro is like the Elizabeth Line in London, but everywhere.
My favourite thing about London, the Elizabeth Line.
The food is amazing.
Is it?
Yes. So I also got incredible selection of restaurants for a small city. Coffee is unbelievably expensive. The coffee is great, but probably the most expensive you'll find anywhere.
Okay.
Swimming all the year round.
Swimming in the...
In the sea.
Swimming all the year round because it's...
Because it's on the sea. That's why you can...
Okay, no, it's not a temperature thing.
No, it's very cold.
Yeah, okay, fine.
And on the reserved... people thing, it's basically assumed that you have multiple hobbies or things to be getting on with outside work. That means you can leave at 4 o'clock. That's just assumed. Regarding the Danes being uncommunicative, Child One says, I would say there is a high barrier for entry with Danes, but if you have a shared interest or invest time in them, they are super willing to hang and be friends. Also, I'm going to get this wrong, Bolmedost, which is a bun with cheese, is a very good selection in Copenhagen or okay. Copenhagen. Also,
are the restaurants expensive?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay, fine.
Also, the national dish, which is smørbrød, which is the open sandwiches, there's a lot of fish. Okay, a lot of fish going down.
Fish.
Yeah. Well, you might enjoy that. But my more general point, and this is based on literally half a dozen visits of a few days each. So this is, you know, put my opinion in yeah. You know, within certain
provisos.
Parameters. It feels to me to be a country at ease with itself.
Well, that's a great compliment.
You know, that, I mean, certainly the health system is in fantastic shape. And
did Child One get paternity leave?
A lot of paternity leave, yes.
I like it even more.
And the hospitals are amazing. You know, so anyway, look, there'll be other people who know absolutely all the things that are wrong with Denmark. But this is a specific question from Alex in Austria. And now a specific question for you. I hesitate even to ask it.
Oh, dear.
But I think you know the answer.
Okay.
It starts... This is from John.
Okay.
Director William Friedkin spoke with William Peter Blatty on revising works that have already been done. In this case,
oh, but this is Bonar.
The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Blatty was talking to Friedkin about revising The Exorcist, in this case, adding in scenes that were not in the original. Friedkin spoke about and referred to the story of a French impressionist painter who was caught in the Louvre Museum in Paris, having snuck in to repaint his own painting that was already up and hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. Whether or not the story is true, I don't know, since Mark is an expert on both Friedkin and Blatty. Can Mark tell us who is the French impressionist artist that Friedkin was talking about? What is his name and the circumstances, if true? Who was caught in the Louvre in Paris repainting his artwork that was already on the wall?
Okay, so I can tell you this definitively because this story is in the public domain because I was the person who wrote it. It was a conversation that I organised between Bill Blatty and Billy Friedkin. It is on the, my BFI book about The Exorcist, the whole of the last chapter is called Late Night Double Bill, and it is a transcription of that conversation in which Bill Blatty, this is before Friedkin went back and actually did put in the extra scenes, Bill Blatty had a number of scenes. They were theological scenes, the conversation on the stairs, the thing at the end, in which he wanted to be in The Exorcist. And Friedkin had had them in his original assembly, and then John Calley had watched it and said, you need to tighten it up. You need to take out the first medical examination because it's called The Exorcist. Everyone knows she's not ill. They know she's possessed. You need to take out the conversation on the stairs because it's... Oh, no, that was the thing that Friedkin himself took out because he thought it was the point at which the film stopped and told you its message because one of them says to the other one, why this girl? It makes no sense. And you need to take out the conversation at the end between Dyer and Kinderman because they have no history, therefore the scene has no weight.
Stop banging the table.
Sorry. And Friedkin agreed to these cuts, very much to Blatty's dismay. Blatty was shut out of the editing room for the final edit. Blatty always thought that those scenes should have gone back into The Exorcist. And when I filmed the two of them together for The Fear of God in 1998, I got them together around a table up in the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. And Friedkin told this story, which was that Blatty said, but the film would be better with them. The film would be better with them. And Friedkin said, well, that may be the case. In fact, years later, he did go back and put those scenes in. He said, but the thing is, whenever anyone talks about this, I am reminded of the story about Pierre Bonnard, who was the French impressionist. Pierre Bonnard, the famous French impressionist painter, who was arrested in the Louvre with a, what do you call it? Is it the thing?
Palette.
With a palette and a paintbrush. And he was touching up one of his own paintings. And the security guard pulled him away. And he said, but I am Bonnard. And the security guard said, it's hanging in the Louvre, pal. Walk away.
Did he say it in that kind of slightly London?
You know, he did it. Well, the way that Billy tells it, you know, Billy does it with his American accent. But and he said, whenever anyone talks to me about going back and doing it, I just always think of that. It's hanging in the Louvre, pal. Walk away.
If you have a question for us, send it to correspondence@codemail.com. Here's the thing. Can I please ask you, please don't send in like a sheet or two of A4 and then go, what do you think? That's not a question. That's not a question.
That was a question, though.
That was a perfect question.
I love that anecdote. I absolutely love that anecdote. And if you get a chance to hear Billy tell it, it's so much better when he does it.
An unusual question to finish. Tom Green says, on a recent return flight from Italy, and whilst abiding by the request to turn phones to airplane mode, I found myself with a troubling combination of no internet access and a fear of flying, which requires podcasts to distract it. Luckily, I had some of your previous episodes downloaded and stumbled upon one where Mark was getting on incredibly well with a fart gun. This has left me pondering a very odd question, which I would like to forward on to you and the fellow Vanguardians. As the breaking of wind is a comedy trope that is found universally amusing, can you think of any on-screen flatulence which was not used for comedy effect? I'm sorry to lower the tone, or we've already had lots of trying hard in this week, and I don't expect this will be read out, but technically, Mark did start it.
Yes, and I can think of an example. The film is the most recent film by Peter Strickland, and it's called Flux Gourmet. And in fact, I think, I'm going to just Google myself, I even remember in my review saying, hang on, yes, here we go. Underpinning all this madness is Papa Dimitriou's wonderfully melancholic portrayal of Stones, a tortured soul, he calls himself just a hack, with painfully flatulent bowels, who submits to horrifying public indignities and whose troubled, world-weary expression will ensure that you never laugh at farts again.
Well, that's not true.
No, I mean, obviously farts are still funny, but Flux Gourmet, which is the Peter Strickland movie, has actually got one of the few, I'm banging the table, one of the very few examples I can think of in which farting is used in a movie for tragic purposes, not funny purposes.
Proper question and a proper answer. Tom, thank you very much indeed. Sorry we didn't get around to all the questions, but if you have a humdinger of a film-related question or a completely non-film-related question, as you might have noticed some of them are, we would love to hear about them, then we can tackle them next week.
Just a clarification, G. David Shine didn't receive an Oscar, but he was the executive producer of The French Connection, which is why he was there when it won the Oscar for Best Film.
Feel free to send in your question to correspondence@curbinameo.com. Don't forget, there'll be a new Take One with you on Friday, and a Take Two, actually, now I think about it.